Song of Songs, chapter 2. We have so far discussed many things regarding, obviously, the text of the Song of Songs. But please understand, as we dive into the scripture text itself, we are discovering the cultural nuance, the people of Israel. The context is very Jewish. And Howard was saying, when the Ancestry.com find out he was not Jewish. In my family, I must tell you this, in my family, there was a secret on my mother's side. And my grandfather, he was one of these guys, you know, he had the chair, you know, that he sat in. Big Gothic chair. I mean, the thing about the whole house was it's Gothic, dark wood. I mean, just, he was a little scary. A little scary. There was a big portrait of him in a uniform, German Army, World War I. You know, the helmet with the little pointy thing. And when you're 6 years old, 7 years old, looking up at something like that, that's daunting. That's a little scary. But there was a secret, and no one knew what the secret was. And I would ask my mother, what are the aunties? What are they talking about? And she goes, oh, we don't know. Grandpa's, there's a secret. And this is for real. They didn't know. And I'm figuring, okay, World War I, Germany. He came in the United States, early part of the 20s. Maybe we have Nazis. How ironic would that be? Maybe the secret was not, you know, we had Nazis. You know, in light of what I do, we minister in Israel. We minister with Jewish people and you know, the seed of Abraham. How ironic would that be? We probably have Nazis. You know, so I'm concluding for years. I think I've talked to you, Pastor. I think we have Nazis. You know, I mean, that's just kind of strange. Ancestry.com. So I check out. I have a couple of names. I have some wedding things and funeral information and trace back my mom's lineage all the way back to the 1700s. You know what the secret was? This blew me out of the water. Back in the late 1700s, our folks were in what was called, formerly called Prussia, okay? Next to the Soviet Union, next to Sweden, Denmark, you know, all of that, Germany. Here, my great-great-grandfather, his name was Zolman. But that's odd. My mother's name is Wagner, or Wagner. Great-great-grandpa, his name was Zolman, he married a Zabel, you know, and they had a whole bunch of kids. Back then, they had a lot of kids, you know, a lot of children. So, here are Zolman kids. They're living in Prussia. My great-great-grandparents decided to change their name from Zolman to Wagner. It's like you have a kid, your name is Smith, you name your kid Rubenstein or something, you know? Okay, so, but it was reversed. They named him Wagner. Why? Who were the Zolmans? They were landowners. Oh, that's pretty cool. What was so unique about them? They were Jewish landowners. Yeah, wow. So, you know, I know my family's been passionate. You know, there's a lot of passion on that side of the family. You know, a little crazy, but passion. Jewish people are... Oh, by the way, that makes me then, you follow that lineage down to my mother. The secret was they didn't know, but they were Jewish. My mother was Jewish. Pastor, you know what that makes me? Jewish. My father was Swedish, so that makes me a Jewish Viking, I guess. I don't know. But the passion. You go to Israel, and everybody's type A. Everybody's passionate about love, passionate about war, passionate about politics, passionate about whatever it is. When we look at the Song of Songs, Solomon, the wisest man, was very passionate. Shulamite, the woman he chose, also was very passionate. This brother playing Hatikva, the passion, it brings me to tears every time I hear that. I wanted to dance. You wouldn't want to see me dance, though. In Israel, I go and I visit Messianic congregations and I speak and I do this and I do that. And so I stood in the back of this congregation. First time there, I wanted to be the wallflower. Blend in where no one would see me. You can't do that when you're 6'2". You just can't do. And they, on this side of the congregation, the women started to dance what is called the hora, the circle. You've seen it. You've seen it, right? They started, and the men over here started dancing over here. I said, okay, this is good. This is good. All of a sudden, the men started this line of dancing going around the little sanctuary. And I'm up against the wall. Did I tell you I was trying to be a wallflower? And I'm up against, and I saw him, he saw me, and he saw me seeing him, and he's leading the, and then, come on, brother, and he grabbed me, and off I go. Off I go, and I have three left feet. It was not fun. I got off at the, the next exit, but there's passion. We learned a Shulamite said, I'm but a rose of Sharon. I'm common. Solomon said, no. You are the lily of the valley. We learned as believers that this is us. We are dough. We are the bread, the common bread. We talked about Shavuot, how on Jewish holidays, oftentimes you'll have unleavened bread, leaven representing sin in the Bible, the flat bread. But on this particular holiday, the day that the church was born, the day that Moses went up the mountain, it's called Shavuot. We call it in Greek Pentecost. And we're the lump of clay that the Lord rips and pulls us, and we wonder what in the world is going on. He's trying to make us a unified loaf. This represents, this loaf of braided bread represents the church. This is what Solomon saw. He didn't see someone common. He saw someone very beautiful. In verse 1 of chapter 2, again, Shulamite says, Solomon, I am the rose of Sharon. And, yes, you're right, the lily of the valleys. The Shulamite is saying, I am just common. I am just a flower of the field. Now, the thing that's fascinating about these flowers is that they grew in the plain or the valley that sloped west to the Mediterranean Sea and reached from Jaffa, which is where Jonah fled from God. Far north up to Mount Carmel, where Elijah was. Now here's a map. You'll see at the very bottom there, you'll see Y-A-F-O, Yafo, on the screen here. Yafo. This is Jaffa, where Jonah took off. And right up here is Haifa, and you have the Mount Carmel range right there. Now that is where the area where Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal. Now this is the port of Jaffa. This is a photo I took, and it was beautiful. This fishing boat was going out of the port. The port is still there. If you've ever been to Israel, you've probably been to this port. It's an ancient port. The rocks, the stones that you see there are actual part of the actual foundation of the port that existed at the time of Jonah. And it just so happened this little boat was going out of the port, and you kind of get a nice visual of what Jonah, he jumped on a boat to run away from God. This is Mount Carmel. Now the mountains in Israel, the highest mountain is about 14,000 feet, and that's Mount Hermon. It's way up in the north. But when you talk about the mountains of Israel, you're talking something that is 2,500, 3,000 feet, maybe 4,000 feet up. But this is part of Mount Carmel, and up here is where Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal. They even have a statue to him. There he is. Okay. Now, verse 2. Like a lily among the thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Like a an apple tree, verse 3. Among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. Now, the apple tree, the shade, the fruit, these are all ancient erotic symbols and erotic suggestions here that she had in mind. You see, in the context of the poem, in the context of the book here, this is the beginning of the wedding night. This intimacy is all encompassing here. She says, I sat down. It can mean to dwell or remain. I remained. I dwelt here. She said, in his shade, I sat down in his shade. The shade speaks of closeness. And this whole experience is described as sweet and full of delight. There is passion here. Look at verse 4. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Now, the fruit and the wine, the banqueting house, literally means house of wine. It symbolized what this banqueting house symbolized, the ecstasy of their intimacy. Now, this is a metaphor for the man's love having a very intoxicating effect on her. In other words, she is delirious with passion for him. Shulamite is delirious with passion for Solomon. Now, in Solomon's pavilion, many historians say that there were emblems of all the tribes over which he ruled. Flags, banners. The banners would have been very noticeable in Jerusalem, at the king's palace. The temple was there. It would have been very impressive. Here you see a series of flags. It would have been something of this nature, but all around, if you can envision the temple and the palace. Here are the actual symbols that represented each tribe. It would have been something of that nature inscribed on the flags themselves. Now, the Shulamite here in the text, the Shulamite had a banner, a flag, which meant more to her than all the banners of Solomon, than all of his kingdom. Beneath that banner, she found all that her heart desired. The banner, the word banner, means desire or intent. Desire or intent. She is saying his intent towards me was love. Now, I was sharing with someone earlier tonight, and I think I may have mentioned this in our first session. I taught this, the book of the Song of Songs, when I was pastoring in San Diego. It took me 8 months to go through it. And my biggest challenge is to break it down into 8 lectures here. But one of the things, now, you may appreciate this, you may not appreciate this. The pastor will appreciate this. Okay, I'm reading, I'm studying this. And I'm looking at what is being said here. I went, oh boy, because I'm going to be teaching this Sunday morning. Oh boy. So I call my pastors in. I have 4 pastors that were on staff with me. And I would say, do you know what Solomon said here? No, pastor, what did he say here? Well, this is what Solomon said. And they went, oh. I said, all right, guys, help me to take this, you know, R-rated thing, and make it PG for Sunday morning. And they did. We worked together. Some of this is consensus, pastor, if you can imagine that. You know? which is the segue to verse 5. Sustain me with cakes of raisins. Refresh me with apples. For I am lovesick. What in the world? Cakes of raisins mixed with apples came to be viewed about 3,000 years ago or so as an aphrodisiac. She was so burning with her passion, with her desire, that she was lovesick. She sought all possible fuel to keep the flame going. Lovesick, we're all adults here, may also mean worn out from this passionate intimacy. So, hence her call for refreshment, raisins with mixed apples, to renew the activities in which her fantasies captured her. This is why I would call the pastors in to say, how am I going to say this? But you can picture this. You can understand this. She's in love with the king of Israel. He's in love with this common girl who's now no longer common. Why? Because now she is the queen, as it were. Look at verse 6. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. Now, Shulamite pictures herself nestled side by side with him in this full, satisfying embrace. She is so absolutely overwhelmed at the thought of the love of her beloved and his love overjoys her. In essence, the marriage has now been consummated. The two have become one. This is what is going on here. Now, jump down to verse 7, and we'll come back to verse 7 later on, perhaps next week. Listen what she says to, again, this is poetry, this is a song, this is something that reflects history, something that did actually happen. She said, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. In other words, what she's saying to all the young women out there who's going, oh my, this is a beautiful love story. I want to be in love. She is saying to all the young ladies out there, you handle this with care, this thing called love. Because love is a very powerful thing. It makes people do really stupid things sometimes. It makes people do very courageous things. It makes people do things that, I tell you, Jewish people have a lot of passion. They do things. They move mountains. Every man here can attest to this. If you're married and your wife believes in you, you can conquer that mountain that's before you. That's a fact. We'll do it just to show off. That's how we're wired. So, you know, my knight in shining armor thing we talked about? He'll show off for you. He just will. He just will. But guys, get the concept of the head, hand behind the neck, behind the, and you're embracing her. She needs security. Anyway, you understand that. Well, let's go back to verse 1. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Now, the word lily in the Hebrew is Shoshana. Shoshana. It just simply can mean rose. Now, this particular flower mentioned can be scarlet, it can be crimson, it can be purple, it can be blue, it can be white. These lilies, thrive in the hidden place, not in town, not in the heart or the bustle of the city, but out in the countryside, in the quiet field. This lily, this rose, bursts forth from even the cracks in the rocks. It's a very powerful, strong plant, flower. Jesus was referring to this flower when he said, "So why do you worry about clothing?" He says, "Consider the lilies of the field." He's talking about this flower. He says, "How they grow, they neither toil nor spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these." If you consider the context here, we can picture Solomon in this incredible royal apparel contrasted to the Shulamite, this common woman. There's King Solomon. She's working out in the field. Why? Because there was a family squabble and her brothers kicked her out and said, "You go work the fields." And she was working the fields. And if you've been to Israel and you've been there in the summertime, oh man, it's as brutal as Texas. I realize I'm talking to Texas here. Texans here. You go, "Yeah, so what? So it's 112. So what? You work out in a field. It is so what? It is a big deal." Her skin became swarthy, very leathery. Now here comes Solomon on his horse. And all of his regalia, all of his kingly robes and entourage, soldiers. And he's checking out one of his fields, one of his areas of his kingdom. And he sees her. He sees this woman. And he's smitten. Doesn't make sense. He's king. Why would he choose her? Now, the Lord says, "Look how they grow. They don't toil, they don't spin." And yet, there's, with Solomon all of his glory, there's none arrayed like one of these. She ended up, this common woman, ended up looking like this, as it were. You see, she was clothed like this with no effort of her own. You remember me telling you the story about the guy who came up and apologized to me last, I think I said this last week. I was speaking at a church, this guy apologized to me, and he says, when you married Louise, I told her father that she could have done better, you know. And she could have. Louise could have done better. Solomon, riding through the field, he was king. He saw this woman. He said, "I choose her." He could have done better, but he chose her. God, do you know our universe, scientists say, astronomers say, in the latest technology, have concluded so far with the technology at hand today that the universe they can measure is 6 billion light years in length, which is beyond my comprehension. And they said the technology in the years to come will probably prove that the universe is somewhat, if not infinitely long and big and huge. Now you think about that. Think of all the billions of stars, all the planets, the galaxies, the solar systems. Think of our solar system and this little blue dot called Earth. God chose to reveal himself on this planet. And when he did, he died on the cross, we know the story. But then he chose you. Now God could have done better. You know that. He could have done better. Solomon could have done better. Yeah, he chose her. She became that.
But could he have done better than that?
God chose you. And he wants you to be like that. Listen. God wants us to stop our toiling and our spinning and allow him to do his work in us. It is the Spirit of the living God indwelling in each member of his bride that makes her all glorious within, the psalmist says. The lily that is scarlet and crimson reminds us that we who believe have been purchased by the blood of Christ. Now, this journey here, I want you to understand something that you may not fully comprehend. Let's talk about Joseph and Mary. Now, Joseph and Mary live up in Nazareth, up north. You see Galilee. You see Nazareth. This is what it looks like today. Now imagine, Mary is about 20 months pregnant. Okay, they get a decree, and they have to go to Bethlehem. Now, to leave Nazareth to go to Bethlehem, you just don't leave Nazareth to go to Bethlehem without a plan. Alright? Because depending on the way you go, it's anywhere between 80 to 100 miles. You say, well, that's not far, they were tough. No. If you can imagine, now up north, now this would have been in the fall time, by the way. Jesus wasn't born in December, you understand. Okay. He would more likely have been born in the fall time, but that's another lecture for another time. So it's fall time. Summer's ending, fall's beginning. It's still hot. Very hot. Okay, up north, it would have been very humid, like somewhat like Texas. Now imagine Miriam would have been around 14 years old. Maybe 15. Joseph would have been anywhere from 18, 19, 20 years old. Nobody but young. They leave this place. Can you imagine? I mean, just that part of the journey, and you're 9 months pregnant. That part of the journey on a donkey or a horse, or if they were walking, this is rugged. All right? They start here. Now, here's a satellite view. I did this. There it is. I want you to see this. Okay? Let's see. Can you see that very well? Anyway, up here is the Galilee, okay? This is the Jordan River. Now, up here, it's all green because of the satellite view. Down here, you start seeing desert and stuff. This is called the Negev. If you've ever been to the moon, that's called the Negev, all right? Nothing lives there. It is terrible. It is terrible. It's the most forsaken place on the planet. It is just absolutely terrible and yet beautiful all at the same time. Now, more than likely, Mary and Joseph would have started up here in Nazareth, would have followed the river. Why? That's a very good question. Now, she's 9 months pregnant. They have to go. And there's the Jordan River. You know, the one hymn, "On Jordan, stormy bank, we stand." The guy never was there. Anyway, there it is. It's like the Trinity River. All right? Beautiful. It's very historic. Very biblical Jordan. Man, this is Jordan. They would have followed Jordan, the Jordan River south. Why? Because there would have been dates, figs, olives, animals, fish, fresh water. They would have stayed close to the river. There's a movie idea of what they would have looked like. See the rocks? See the mountain? This is actual footage and understanding. This is what the Judean desert is like. They would have traveled down to Jericho, which even today it's a Palestinian controlled area. Even today, there are robbers, there are bad guys. It's a very dangerous place. You really don't want to stay overnight in Jericho if you can possibly bypass that. Then there were robbers and thieves. They would have to go down all the way to Jericho and then begin to ascend the mountains. You know the story of the Good Samaritan? The guy was beaten up, and people were just walking over him, not paying attention to him. The religious walked over him, then the Samaritan came and helped him. It was in that area the story was birthed. This is a very dangerous area. Today there's a big highway there, but even driving this highway, they widened the highway, thankfully. But even it was dangerous. You'll see the camel. There's always a camel at sea level. There's this guy with a camel on you. For a buck, you can ride the camel. But it's a dangerous area. They would have walked 4 days, 5 days. By the time you get to Jericho, it's 115, 120, maybe 125 degrees. She's 9 months pregnant. You see the mountains and behind this city here? This is Bethlehem today. Back then, there would have only been around 200 people. But do you see the mountains in the back? Mary and Joseph would have to have negotiated these mountains. Coming up on the backside, going up to Bethlehem, I guarantee you, now Mary, young as she was and strong as she was, she's exhausted now. She's gone about 80 to 100 miles on a donkey, on a horse, or walked, however she got there. Joseph is on alert for bad guys. Why? Because he's a guy. He probably has a knife, he has a stick, he may have a club. He may have a slingshot. He's going to protect his wife. They negotiate now Bethlehem, which is oh so beautiful. If you've ever been, how many have been to Israel? Go, you must go, you know. Bethlehem is beautiful in the winter, in the spring. Now it's probably was still very much brown as you saw in the previous photo. They probably talked about David, because David lived there. They probably talked about the love story of Ruth and Boaz, because that took place there. And they probably, because a lot of very unique and miraculous things were happening to them, they may have even discussed, didn't one of the prophets say that the Messiah was to come in Bethlehem? And oh my goodness, the angel, and the baby's not yours, Joseph, and maybe you can, and just and then the decree, and we have to be here. This can't be coincidence. A lot of discussion. So they negotiate these terraced hills to go to this village of about 200 people, and there was probably only one or two places that could facilitate outsiders, and that was all full up. And so the innkeeper, as we say, he gets a bad rap in some of our stories. But he did the best he could. But I want to show you what the best was. Okay, when we think of the story of Mary and Joseph, we think of this, don't we? There they are in the manger scene, you know, Christmas songs playing in the background, you know, or grandma's house, and you know, and we look at that, and that's a lovely painting, isn't it? I wish I could paint like that. My wife's the painter. Oh, you ought to see some of her stuff. But, oh, my goodness, that's what we see. You know what it was? That Bethlehem has thousands of caves. Here's one of the caves. People would have put animals in there. There might have been food in there, hanging, meat hanging. But here's a cave. Now there's a beautiful church over this place now, called the Church of the Nativity. But here's what it would have looked like. Mary and Joseph, Mary about 14, 15, Joseph 18, 19, they make this 4 or 5 day journey through the most hellish places on earth to ascend these rugged mountains through this godforsaken desert to reach this ancient city of Bethlehem to find that there's no place to put her up, and she ends up in a cave maybe 15 feet from Main Street. Miriam, Mary. Honestly, people, because of the decree, would have infused that little village. There may have been a couple of thousand people by this time, which was a big deal then. She's in this cave. People are walking to and fro. Like, it would be like from where I'm standing to the door. And there are people, maybe even look, maybe where you guys are sitting, to the door. There's this woman, this young girl, she's pregnant, seriously pregnant. And they're poor. They have nothing. Joseph was a carpenter. It doesn't mean he had, like, he built wood things. It's unfortunate translation. He was a stonemason. Now, he would have worked with wood, yes. But principally, he would have worked with stone. He was a rugged, tough man. You know, English translation, carpenter. He worked with stone and wood. So he's a rugged man. He has tools. He has hammers and things. But his wife is pregnant. I don't care how smart you are, gentlemen. Your wife is pregnant. She's going to give birth. You are freaking out. It's just the way it is. When our older son, let me say, when our older son was born, it was when they were just starting to let the fathers in. You know, that's how old I am. They were just starting to let us in. And I remember standing there and it was a wonderful. And the doctor, he was an old hippie doctor. He was a smart guy, but he was a hippie. Anyway, he looked at me. He says, "Yo, Jeff," he says, you know, and I'm like, you know, I'm 19, right? He goes, "If you pass out, we're going to put you in a corner, man. You understand? It's not about you, buddy. It's not about you." I said, "All right, yeah, far out peace, you know. It's all right. I'm cool. But, you know, okay, let me back up. I'll tell you, silly. If Louise was unable to be here tonight because of previous things that had to be cared for, and she would be embarrassed, but she's not here, so I'm going to tell you. So there she was, man, 36 hours in labor. Yeah, you ought to see our kid. He's 6'5", you know. Anyway, and he got all his mother's smarts. He's a smart guy. Anyway, so we're in there. So, did I tell you they just let us in? You know, the father's in. So, you know, you got the mask, the whole thing, and then those paper shoes. Did I ever tell you? Did I tell you this story? The paper shoes. And I walk in there, and she's in a lot of pain. Now, I got to fix this. You know, I got to fix this. So, and I'm looking at you guys. I know you guys got the short straw on this. Can I sit right here? May I? Is that okay? She goes, "Oh my word! Why? I didn't want to come to this." Okay. So I'm sitting here, and she's like in pain, and I'm trying to. So I thought, I'm going to take off these paper shoes, and I'm going, "Do do do do." You know, I'm trying to make her laugh. Didn't work. And I had longer hair then. She grabbed my hair, pulled me down. She said, "Shut up." I said, "Okay, this strength, man. I mean, this, honestly, you know, and there's still bald spot. Anyway, but, you know, so I learned, okay, just shut up." And it was beautiful. It was beautiful. They had the doctors, the nurses, all the things, the latest state-of-the-art medical stuff was there. They were in a cave. There was nothing state of the art. She went into labor, Mary. Joseph was doing what he could do. People walking by, maybe somebody walked in and helped, but it's not recorded, so we don't know. She gave birth. She more than likely would have cut. See, Bedouin women do this. This is why I say that. She would have cut, can you imagine this? The umbilical cord. Wrapped him in swaddling clothes. You know what swaddling clothes are? They were just pieces of her ragged clothing. It's that simple. Some say, well, burial clothing. Yeah. It was pieces of her poor. You remember the common shepherdess you saw? It would have been one of pieces of her clothing. Now, the thing that I marvel at. That thing there, you know, you put grain in there for the donkeys and the cattle and the goats and what have you to feed there. They may have put water in there, maybe. That is the manger. Yes. God, you see, Solomon could have chosen anyone, but he chose her. God could have chosen anyone, but he chose you. The Son of God, God decided to reveal himself, as he said through the prophets, to be born in Bethlehem, in a cave, in a stone trough. Miriam, 14, 15-year-old kid, giving birth all by herself with a freaked out Joseph. And yet God chose Joseph to instill, to move it forward in little Yeshua, what it means to be a man. There's that humanity part too, you know. But you must understand the context that Jesus was born. Okay, that's nice. That's a postcard thing. Take the three wise men out. They didn't come technically for a couple of years after the birth. So take the three wise men out of the cave there. And you have a pretty good idea. She was just a few feet from the entrance. Now, I want you to look at this. Mary gave birth, and there's a beautiful song where she kissed him, and she was kissing the face of God. You've heard the song. 33 years later, or so, she's standing at the foot of a cross. This is a historic archaeological drawing. This is what it probably looked like. They would have stripped him of everything. He would have been only a few feet off the ground. Do you remember the context in Matthew where the Pharisees were making fun at him and said, ah, they were sitting there as though they put lawn chairs there. Ah, he saved others, but he can't save himself. If you be the Son of God, come down. If they stood, if they were tall, they could probably look them almost in the eye. Jesus would have hung there, bent like that, just a few feet off the ground. The women were there. John was there. The rest of the guys fled. People mocked. There were people weeping. She gave birth in a cave to the Son of God. She kissed his bloody face. When he was born, and she did it 33 years later as well. This is some story, an incredible story. They put him here. Remember me telling you about they had to extend the place where the body was put? I'll explain that. For those that are visiting tonight, this is called Gordon's Calvary. This is more than likely on a scale of 1 to 10. This is at least a good 9, maybe an actual 10. There's evidence of a second century foundation around this tomb. It was a rich man's tomb, only about 30 yards from the place of execution, the place of the skull, and. Archaeologists are perplexed that, okay, this was a rich man's tomb, they said, the rich family's tomb, and the places where the bodies would have been put was cut to specific dimensions. So, I mean, this was something. This is some area. And yet they didn't find bone boxes, which is tradition in the Jewish community. That, in other words, this wasn't a typical thing, event that happened here. There, on the side here, you will see a fascia crack. Oh, there it is. I did that. Fascia crack right over here. Earthquakes. It's a seismic area, but geologists are baffled that it was a localized earthquake on the north side of Moriah. They don't know why. We know why. The scripture says there was an earthquake. Okay, now, you go into the tomb, you go into an area where there might be a half a dozen, you could put a half a dozen people there. And this is me teaching with one of our groups about a year ago. And we take them into the tomb. There's a door there. You've seen it. He is risen. Now we take them in there and we shut the door, which is very daunting and startling. But it gives them an idea. There's an open window called the Nefesh window. The Jewish people believed on the fourth day the soul would leave that window and ascend to God and this or forth. This is why Jesus rose on the third day, because on the fourth day they considered the body to be corrupt. And the scripture says that the Messiah will not see corruption. That's why Jesus rose on the third day. One day before, the body was technically considered corrupt. So you can go in there and you read the gospel text and you read that Peter and John went there and Mary went there and they all stood in there. And this is where they were. They were looking to the right. Now there's a gate there, so you can't get in there, but this is what they're looking at. Okay, what you have here, this is one of the areas where a body would have been. Another body would have been put here. And there's another location here that you don't see. There would have been for three people. Now, what is so fascinating about this, the place where the head would have been is raised just a little bit. So you know, this is where the Lord's head would have been. And the feet was lower. But one thing, and I don't know if you can see this clearly unless you're in the center here, there's right at the end here. Now, this would have been simply a flattened wall where the feet would have been for specific dimensions for a specific person, Joseph of Arimathea. But something is perplexing here. Right here on the feet, where the feet would have been, somebody, they don't know who, took a chisel, hammer, and extended the bed. Now you put all these components together. You have a rich man's tomb with no bone boxes, no bones in there. It was technically never used, but yet it was used. They even extended the bed to facilitate a taller body. Apparently, Jesus was a little taller than Joseph of Arimathea. And they did it in haste. As the scripture says, they buried them. He was buried in haste, very quickly. Now, unfortunately, our time is up. But these are lilies of the valley. Many colors, many sizes, many shapes. For our purposes this evening, let's just go back and go over this. You know, Louise could have chosen anyone. She chose me. Solomon could have chosen anyone. But he chose Shulamite. God could have chosen anyone, but he chose you. He went through all that, as it were, Mary, Joseph, God becoming man in this most incredible way, from Nazareth to Bethlehem, through the most horrible places in Israel, to ascend up to Bethlehem. They would have seen Jerusalem. They would have seen the edifice of the temple and all of that going to Bethlehem. To go into a cave so that the incarnation, God becoming man, could happen. Amazing. 33 years later, he's crucified. He's put in this cave that you saw, that sepulcher, but he's not there. He's the king, and yet he chose you. He could have chosen anyone. Ladies and gentlemen, you're the lily of the valley. You're different size, different shape, different gender, different color, different background, but you all comprise that braided loaf that represents the body, the bride of Christ. You're that important to God. Now, our responsibility is to live. Let's move this forward a little bit. You're the lily. This is who you are. You were the plain shepherdess. You were a common person. You were a sinner. Now you're saved by grace if you believe. You have been adorned in regalia. Let's look at verse 10 and 11 of chapter 1. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. This common girl became this. You are also the bride of the King. You have been given golds of chain, or chains of gold as it were, studs of silver. He has taken you from this place and elevated you here. That's who you are.